this yet. Let me see if I have it straight. The bill as before those amendments effectively opened up the statute of limitations without limit.
Yes.
In other words, it was just open forever.
And for every, and in this, and in one of those, for, is it sub B also for a whole broader public,
right.
Almost anybody?
Almost anybody.
Right.
So. Then that's all taken out.
Right.
Civil action for property damage.
Yeah. Catherine might respond to tell you exactly what it does, in fact. Catherine?
If you're looking for the time period on the statute, it starts on line, the end of line 8, and it's for 2 years after the effective date of the act.
And then it would be closed for private, nonprofit, elementary, or secondary school buildings be closed, right?
Right. They can no longer take a cause of action after that time.
Any of them, whether or not they've discovered the asbestos by this time or anything. It just says, well, if you haven't, you should have.
Okay. Now, no, not should have. They come under federal law as well as the public schools to have developed a plan by.
Okay, 19th
April of 89. So they are included in the federal act of having to investigate the buildings, come up with a plan, et cetera, et cetera. So they come under the federal law with having to act, and they do have the same deadline as the public schools, is my understanding and testimony from Mr. Slater. So what we're doing here is allowing them to kind of have their chance at a lawsuit when the public schools have no statute of limitations at all, according to court ruling.
Okay. I was not able to be here at the last hearing on this. I think there have been two hearings so far, have there not?
Yes.
These amendments are just being introduced today, right?
No.
Were they discussed at the last hearing?
Yes, Senator, they were.
Was there opposition to the amendments to the bill as it would be amended?
I suppose there's general theoretical opposition to the bill from people who don't want any statute of limitations change at all. You know, those folks are still there. It is down to a point where I think it's manageable, and I'd like to bring it to an up or down vote.
I was just trying to catch up with the hearing since I wasn't able to be there.
There was no one here to testify.
Arguments against it.
I would say to you that there has been no one ever testified in opposition to this bill that I can recall. Catherine?
I don't remember either, Senator.
Okay, so that's what I was wondering.
They did not come in at the last hearing either.
Okay. Okay, thanks. That's what I needed to know.
The chair would move. Okay, do we have objections to the amendments? I guess I didn't.
We did that, didn't we?
Did we do that?
No.
Sort of. Okay, hearing done, so ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 966-4966 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I think Senator Springer already moved it.
That would be
That's
my
what,
motion.
He moved the amendments, I'm sorry. Yeah, and I'm
I
in
would
error.
Move the bill as amended
Thank
to
you.
The floor, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Springer moved Senate Bill 966.
Madam Chair, before voting on the bill, I need to disclose a conflict of interest in that my law firm does represent at least one asbestos manufacturer.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I guess I would disclose a similar conflict. I note, though I don't think I was here, we've got a written testimony of a Mr. Henry Cantor, who's an attorney in private practice in the same law firm where I'm employed.
Neither of you were here for those sterling testimonies.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to say that I do not have a conflict.
Why not?
Although I probably went to a school that had asbestos in it.
Right. Be careful.
You work in a building that's got asbestos in it.
Yeah, call the roll, right, please. Now. Pat.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. This is the 100th bill we've passed out of this committee.
Civil Committee, Senator.
Civil Committee. The Civil Committee. Oh, we haven't. Well, it's more
we
than
should
that.
Probably
about
take
160
a break, then, huh?
or 160.
160. This is 100
wow.
of Catherine's bills.
My gosh.
100 of Catherine's bills. We probably have 60 of Jack's, so we're getting to the 200 bills.
And the train is still on the track.
Yes. And we just made a deal. We just made it, the chair just made a deal with Senator Karen, so we've snatched the Labor Committee members till 5 o'clock at least on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays.
Some kind of a deal.
I don't know who the Labor Committee is going to meet on Saturday.
Who wanted that deal? That's what I want to know. Did you get a couple options or draft picks?
We're meeting Saturdays, Ron.
Right.
Labor Committee meets all day Saturday.
Right.
And Monday.
Okay, folks, I get down to serious business here.
No, you're kidding.
Let's do 2529, and that one we need to give a call to Nancy Peterson's office. And Catherine will go through the amendments. Well, I hope, I'm going to take about a few of these work session bills that we can get out of the way, and then we'll turn to 1073 with Jack about 2 o'clock when everybody arrives. Okay.
1073.
Do you want to
do
this
one? 2529. Catherine.
I have some amendments in it.
We have two sets of amendments?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Actually, there are three, but there are two packets.
Wow.
Just go send it out to just you know, get the time on here if you need to.
Okay.
I'm on the wrong if you'll send him a note on my station.
Catherine.
Yes, Senator. This bill is the bill relating to the maintenance of easements, and it provides a statutory as well as a contract remedy for people who fail to maintain their easements. A second, I'm looking for my notes on it. Okay, in the packet which is labeled Hand and Gross, Peterson and Electric Utilities, there are two amendments that were before the committee previously. One was introduced by Representative Peterson and the other by the League of Public Owned Utilities. And specifically what they do on the second page of the bill is they change in Section 6 the easements which are affected by the bill, and they change it from all easements created on or after the effective date of the Act, October 1st, 1989, which is a prospective bill, and they change it to one which would apply to easements existing on or created after the October 1st, 1989 date. The second one changes municipal electric utilities to municipally owned utilities, broadening the utilities that would come under the exemption. The other amendment that you have is labeled Weber, and it's May 26, 1989. And it deals with the issue of what damages are the appropriate damages. In the bill, you have two causes of action or two types of actions that you can take. One would be on a contract, and the other would be on the statute. On the third page, I did a bit of a diagram to lay out for you the choices of damages. Basically, we're looking at money and action damages, like specific performance. And under contract damages, the bill as it's now written now allows specific performance. Under non-contract remedies, you have contribution. And I've added language which would add money damages to the contract, so you'd have money damages and specific performance on the contract. And then for non-contract remedies, that is a remedy on the statute, the choice would be contribution to get money or other equitable relief, which would allow the court to order a owner or person who shares in the easement to perform certain actions.
So our choices are in the right-hand column, is that correct, Catherine,
Actually,
to decide whether we want to ask the court to allow them other equitable relief or to talk about a specific dollar contribution?
On the contract, yes.
On the contract.
Yes, and the result with the amendments that I put in there, if there's a contract, you could get money damages or specific performance. If it's a statutory action, you could get contribution, which is money, or other equitable relief, which is in order to perform a certain act or restrain.
So this is not a choice. This is what is encompassed in your, all of the above are encompassed in your amendments dated May 26th. Is that right?
Yes, Senator. Right now, the bill only allows specific performance and contribution.
Okay. And Catherine has been working diligently with the legislative council folks who, I think Catherine spent many more time, more hours on trying to get this clarified so it's workable and the language actually says what it's supposed to say than we probably necessarily would have devoted otherwise. But Senator Brenneman.
So the problem is Roy Ockert has a road that he's granted some easements on, and when it comes to maintaining it, he's the only one. The other people, neighbors, are going across it, not paying their share, keeping it up, and it's gotten irritated. And that's what this takes care of. And anybody opposed to the amendment?
Nancy?
Huh?
Well, certainly, Nancy, are you aware of any opposition to the amendments?
No, are these the amendments?
Any or all of them. So why don't you come on up and tell us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Nancy Peterson, District 52. In terms of the amendments that Catherine has developed, I haven't heard any opposition.
Okay.
Now, I assume you have on hand the amendment that I am offering.
Right.
And that's the one that suggests that it will be retroactive rather than just prospective.
It would be existing.
Right, existing easements.
Existing easements would come under that. I guess I don't have any problem with doing that. An easement is an easement, and if you have to go back to brand new easements, you're not doing much for anybody at all with the bill. And I don't have a problem with adopting the amendments, all of them that are here, frankly.
I don't either. And
good.
I'll move this Hannon Gross one, Peterson. Electric utility, okay. Marking on the top.
Great. Senator Brenneman has moved the Hannon Gross amendments, Peterson Electric Utility. Would you also like to move the Weber amendments at the same time?
I was going to do that next, but I'll do it now in the same motion.
I think so, unless I don't hear any concern from committee members on this. Senator Brenneman also moves the amendments dated May 26th offered by Weber. Objections to those amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
And Madam Chair, I'd move it to the floor as amended with a due pass.
Right. Senator Brenneman has moved House Bill 2529 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Are there further discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Aye.
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 Hi, thank you very much. Thanks, Nancy.
I appreciate your work. It's real swift over here.
Swift but thought.
It's most of it. It's Catherine who does such good work ahead of time.
And I don't like
thanks. Okay.
I voted for it.
Okay, sorry. And Grinsky does good work, too.
I voted for it.
He voted for it. We appreciate that. And also, Representative Peterson appreciates that. Next work session. Sure. We've got two public hearings on 2561 that we don't, I don't know if the person was here yet on that one. Karen from the School Board Association had to step out and she said she'd be back. 2583, the beekeeper bill, Catherine, 2583. Do we have anyone signed up? Come on up, please. Mr. Van Natta. Catherine has amendments on this one. They're a civil penalty issue.
I am Fred Van Natta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. This makes a number of changes in the authority of the Department of Agriculture to enforce laws and rules regulating the requirements to register honeybees in the state of Oregon. Those pieces of the bill have been reviewed by both agricultural committees, but because essentially there has been no enforcement in the field, the beekeepers suggested civil penalties. Apparently that has not been something that's been in the Department of Agriculture before, although I understand there are other pieces of legislation that would have the Department of Agriculture have civil penalty authority this session. The provision for civil penalties and the provisions of this bill were discussed for about a year and a half among the beekeeping industry, so it would come as no surprise to them. In the original bill were some boilerplate language provided by legislative counsel on civil penalties. I think your staff has substantially improved the civil penalty language. We've had an opportunity to review it and support it.
Thank you. Other questions?
Just briefly,
Senator Schrager. Yes.
Fred, since this came from our Ag and Natural Resource Committee, has there been any other change to the provisions that we considered aside from the penalty issue?
The amendments you have before you address nothing but the civil penalty. They delete the existing language on civil penalties and then insert a much more elaborate civil penalty provision and do not address and don't touch the rest of the bill. There was an issue on line 9 about the person to whom the notice is addressed, whether the number of days they should have from the date of mailing of the notice to make a written application for a hearing. We've debated that some, and perhaps the 20 days is an adequate period of time. There's some concern because the beekeeping business is a migratory business, and they are occasionally, the professionals in the business are occasionally on the road. My guess is those are not the people that these penalties would be addressed toward anyway. It would be more likely people who have bees and are simply neglecting them and thus spreading disease. So I think the 20 days is probably all right.
Thank you. Spring, you're going to move the adoption of amendments?
Move the amendments, Madam Chair.
Amendments to 2583-B4 amendments. Are there objections to those? Hearing none, so ordered.
Move the bill as amended.
Senator Springer moves House Bill 2583 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
No. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you might want to ask Senator Kintai if he'd be interested in carrying this. He's an old beekeeper and took quite an interest in this bill when it was down before our committee.
Okay. Happy to do that. Karen arrived for House Bill 2561. Okay, we'll carry that one over. Sort of a simple bill that we keep kind of not quite getting to.
Interchange.
Yes. She did come and apologize that she had to be done. Jack. Am I blind, or didn't we have this one up yesterday?
We had it up just a couple days ago.
Why do we have it again? Oh, cool. Okay, excuse me. Let's go ahead and do it then.
All right.
Are there no amendments?
There is an amendment.
There is an amendment?
Yes.
2668. This bill deals with the civil actions on individuals who've been harmed by sexual abuse, and we have people here who are offering amendment I want to say to members, you had some of the best testimony that you missed, unfortunately. It wasn't your fault who had to go the other day on this bill. It was rather convincing that we need to move the bill in its, at least in its approximately in its current form. At least it convinced me.
That's correct, Madam Chair. This is essentially the civil version of the extension of the statute of limitations in sex abuse cases. There is an amendment proposed by sort of a joint venture between Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and Mr. McMenamin's firm. As the Chair will recall, we heard a suggestion that it was unclear in the present bill whether the bill included, I guess, vicarious liability for principals. And the amendment is a proposal to make that clear that, for instance in the case of abuse perpetrated by a member of the clergy, to extend that. And we have a representative from OTLA and Mr. McMenamin from here. Committee has any questions?
Okay. Maybe you ought to go over the issue just concisely and briefly for committee members who missed this discussion during the hearing.
Very briefly.
If you would, please, Mark.
I'm Mark Williams, an attorney practicing with McMenamin and Associates in Portland. The testimony that we heard the other day concerned people who were victims as children, and there was professional and victim testimony about the problems associated with that, the suppression, the fact that the abusers are the people in control, and that the problems that presented in trying to deal with that while those people are still minors. This gives an additional 5 years after the minority to first discover the problem, seek treatment, and then seek a legal remedy. This amendment specifically deals with how they're going to pay for the damages that they've sustained and the treatment that they've sustained. One victim that we had testify in particular is now on welfare. Her children were also abused by the abuser. They are also getting counseling. She has been reduced from being a productive citizen to someone that the state of Oregon is supporting in both the most rudimentary needs, but also paying for her counseling. The person who is responsible for her abuse was prosecuted, is serving a 30-year term in the state penitentiary, but as this bill stands, it's not clear that anyone but that particular individual can be sued civilly to obtain any kind of recovery. Jack stated that this would extend to vicarious liability. I think that's an overstatement. It's definitely an overstatement, because vicarious liability would imply that that these people, just because of their employment relationship, their employer would be responsible if they were abusing people and they happen to be employed. That is not what this language does. What this language does is address the concern that an employer that puts an employee in a position where they're supervising children, and that employer is actively negligent in its supervision, then that employer can be held liable. Otherwise, of course, it would not be within the scope of the employment. A sexual abusive act would not fall within the scope of employment, and there would not be vicarious liability as such. I think it's arguable that the language as it stands does accomplish our purpose. The amendment adds a clause which makes it crystal clear that would come in.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
any questions?
There is now the tort of allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse. I mean, that is, you can now sue for these sort of collateral offenses?
You can sue for negligent supervision or breach of fiduciary duty. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, I guess.
Jack.
I think that what the Senator is asking, correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, I didn't mean to jump in, but is the issue that we discussed the other day, whether this is the appropriate tort language.
Yeah, that's essentially the question. I'm not aware of a tort that speaks in that language, although I'm not a tort lawyer.
Okay, I think you need to, and Judy actually responded
didn't she, if I, my memory's right, to that question and said you'd worked it over in the House and you couldn't come up with any better language?
Madam Chair, I think that is a succinct summary of what I stated, and I know that's not the best way to approach it. This bill, as it initially was conceived many months ago, started off in a substantially different form. And the version that you see now arose as a result of amendments proposed by Representative Mannix on the House side. The reason these amendments occurred was out of a desire on the part of the members of the House Judiciary Committee considering the bill to be sure that we were narrowly defining the nature of the conduct for which the statute of limitations was being expanded. I can assure you, Senator Shoemaker, it was not out of any desire to expand the various causes of action that might be permissible under the statute, but rather to define it specifically to exclude any conduct that might otherwise just be pure negligent injury to a child, such as we might find if there was a fall on a school playground or in a sporting event, or a personal injury action arising out of a motor vehicle collision, but to narrowly define it in a manner that really hasn't previously defined in standard tort law. I mean, you cannot turn to a section of our customary assault and battery or personal injury pleadings and find something that is this narrowly restricted. It's restricted to that to the extent it defines child abuse. Perhaps it's broader in a sense in that it refers to the whole array of sexual exploitation. But we've been through that in discussions and believe that within the context of the current torts for assault and battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress, for example, that you could virtually, or even invasion of privacy, excuse me, the third one, that you would plead them within those tort concepts using this statute as a means of analyzing merely the statute of limitations issue.
Okay, so this statute, or the amendment, you are stating on the record then that it is not intended to broaden or any present cause of action or create any new cause of action. It's merely to extend the statute of limitations for whatever existing cause of actions there might be.
That's correct, Senator Shoemaker. Okay. That's supported by the legislative history on this House side, and it's been pointed out to me, and I stand reminded that at line 23 and 24, section 3.
Yes, I see that.
Clarifies
see that.
That
now.
And that also was put in on the House side to make that as clear as possible.
Changing the focus a bit, one of the principal reasons to have statutes of limitations, of course, is to prevent against staleness of evidence, loss of evidence, loss of an ability to defend yourself because you cannot marshal the evidence that you could have had an action been brought closer to the time of commission. That is the main purpose of the statute of limitations. To vary that statute requires a pretty strong public showing of need to do that and a strong public purpose. And I agree that it should be extended for a child abuser because that evidence is, for one thing, is probably not the type of evidence that's going to be as hard to marshal as some other evidence might be. And also because of the...
Well, okay, I'm going to cut you short.
Well, I don't... I want to say that I'm troubled by this because this could bring
I
into the
that,
net...
I know that, but... I'm going to stop you and say that let them explain the answer to your question. They're clear on that. We've gone through that question. I want them to restate it for you. Why is this different than the issue of stale evidence? And in a few words, if you would just describe what the witnesses went through so that Senator Shoemaker can understand what the testimony was.
Now, I'm not relating to the bill as originally engrossed. The abuser himself, I understand that, and I'm quite agreeable with that.
Okay.
I'm concerned with this amendment, which extends the statute for those who are only collaterally involved in the offense and who may have been a teacher or a superintendent in an institution when something like this went on, and now you're bringing him into court. It could be like 20 years after the offense occurred. And it's going to be very hard for that person to respond appropriately to the complaint. Much harder for him, it seems to me, than for the offender himself. So I'm troubled at extending this to these collateral.
Who's the him? I think the him is the institution.
The him is the abuser, and you don't have a problem with the abuser.
Right.
In addition, it's the institution, right?
Or any other person who might have been involved in it, if I read this correctly.
Well, if they were directly involved as a person, then they were an abuser.
Well, you could have one of the spouses, perhaps, I suppose, allowing, permitting, or encouraging. Encouraging, that's getting pretty close, but allowing or permitting is sort of suffering it to happen. That, I suppose, could occur somebody who could involve a person who was involved in the relationship and somehow and might have been able to prevent it but didn't. That person could be brought in if there is, you know, if there's negligence involved there. That person could be brought in, and this would extend the statute on that person.
If I may, Madam Chair.
I'm troubled.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker.
Your name, please.
I'm Stephen Taylor, also from Mr. McMiniman's office, an associate of Mr. Williams here. Again, to restate for Senator Shoemaker's benefit, we represent a number of victims in this situation. One of the recurring themes that we see in those cases is not only the abuse by the person who is physically involved, but active concealment by others. And specifically, one of the people who was here to testify the other day.
It was not on the original list, and I'm sure that they do. It was not put to us as a major concern that they had. I asked early on if anyone could give me examples of cases that might fit the or test but not the and test. And we've talked about other, I think, more pressing issues to the DAs and have not resolved this one. I don't think it's irresolvable if they think it makes a huge difference in the law. I felt if they thought it made a huge difference in the law, we would have heard a great deal more about it. The DAs are here. I'm sure they're going to testify, if not today, on Wednesday. And
Kathleen, I wonder if it might be useful to mention that when we talked about the date just now, it sort of rang a bell with me, to mention that some of these amendments, if I'm not mistaken, are in response to the Attorney General's opinion. Did we discuss that already, and I just don't remember it? Or?
We didn't discuss it, and I haven't gotten to any of those amendments yet. And I'm not sure that the AG's opinion has been formally... I'd ask Mr. Wassman where we are with the AG.
He's nodding his head, yes. I didn't mean to bring this up out of the right sequence. I just...
Okay.
We'll be getting to
it. I'm authorized to talk about the AG's. Yes, I will point out where there were some. The interesting thing is that the points raised in the AG opinion were raised also from other sources. So I was prepared to talk about them regardless. I'll do that. Section 14 on page 7 of the bill provides that when consecutive sentences are imposed under the guidelines, there is a maximum to the sentence that can be imposed, and it will be as provided by rule. The section 15 is simply, I believe, conforming language. It's existing law that has to do with release of a defendant from a county jail. This simply includes those defendants who are there because of being sentenced under the rules. You'll kick me if I'm wrong. Right.
Okay. Well, I'll just note that this also tries to clarify that under the guidelines there won't be such a thing as a suspended sentence, and the language here is intended to capture that.
Section 16 of the bill is existing law about probation conditions. The changes are on, the language is on page 8. The boldface language makes it clear that existing law applies to offenses committed prior to the guidelines. The language at lines 26 to 29 about not ordering restriction to residence, I believe, is borrowed from existing law someplace else and is not new to you. It appears above at line 20. Section 17 of the bill is existing law that has to do with probation the term of probation and the revocation of probation. And the change to that that's before you today in amendments is on page 10 at line 19. And I will say that this was an issue raised by the Attorney General's opinion. It was also an issue raised by the State Court Administrator's office. We are proposing to take out the section that now appears starting at line 19. That language would have given all defendants whose probation was revoked after September 1st a penalty under the sentencing guidelines, which would mean a six-month prison term or the guideline sentence that could have been imposed. The constitutional problem that we ran into is an ex post facto one. In some instances, the sentence under the guidelines for the revocation might be longer than the sentence the person would receive under the existing law. So we are backing off of that approach and are proposing to eliminate Section 4, and there's a new section before you. I think, Bob, do you want to explain what that does? It's a new amendment to the existing law at subsection 4 of 137550, and we'll simply be adding in at line 26.
It merely indicates that a sentence that is a probationary sentence under the guidelines is distinct from a probationary sentence as under the existing law or current law of indeterminate sentencing, that there is no suspended sentences under the guideline system. So the parallel language has been added here in subsection 4.
There is also new language to deal with how the parole board will deal with probation revocations under guidelines, and there are about three. When we get to the end of the bill, there are about three sections of new language that I'd like to just do all at once for you. Section 18 is new language that has to do with supervisory authority. When a person is confined to the county jail or a county program, we're proposing at line 44 that the judge must determine that space is available in a custodial facility by consulting with the supervisory authority. So we're proposing that language be added at line 44 that would accomplish that. Section 19 is all new language that has to do with fingerprinting. Current law requires that fingerprints be taken at arrest for felonies and certain Class A misdemeanors, mostly sex and drug-related misdemeanors. Current law also requires the court to inquire at arraignment whether someone has been fingerprinted, and if not, to order them fingerprinted. This proposal is to get rid of that inquiry by the court at arraignment, and instead what we really want to do is get good records on people who've been convicted. If we can't get good records on people who've been arrested, we'll settle for good records on people who've been convicted. This would require the court to inquire upon conviction of a felony or any Class A misdemeanor if fingerprints had been taken, if they had not, to direct that they be taken. I think that the state police have some language to offer relating to fingerprinting and the improvement of records, which is important for criminal history scoring purposes.
Yes, Senator Springer.
I know this has kind of raised flags for folks before. When we're talking about the volume, has there been any estimate of the cost of the thousands of folks on DUII or DWS who probably are not being fingerprinted now that this would pick up?
Senator Springer, the State Court Administrator's Office is developing a fiscal impact statement for the bill as a whole, and I think that their response was they were going to inquire whether the prints had been taken and then direct them to be taken. So I guess if there is a fiscal impact, it's coming from the state police, who are back here. I don't know what that impact is right now. I don't know if...
Have you heard a figure that just sets a ballpark cost to, quote, take a set of prints?
I have not.
I know, I don't know what the police charge if you go in and ask for a set, say for expungement purposes. I think it may be $10, or used to be about $10, but hopefully we get that information a little bit later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There is a number that I do know, and that's the difference between what is currently required to be taken and what remaining Class A misdemeanors are not sex or drug-related misdemeanors. And I think Catherine Ashford has, it's some small percentage, is it not? The remaining Class A misdemeanors are a very small percentage of. Section 21 is the new language relating to appeals under the guidelines. And I don't know if perhaps counsel wants to explain the amendments that are being proposed for this section and. Jack, would you like me to say what our four amendments are to this section, and then you can do the more sure. the more meaty
sure.
language? Okay. At line 19 and line 21, we want to add to make clear that these are sentences of probation without departure. In other words, it's an optional probationary sentence. No departure findings are made. And that those are the kinds of sentences that are not to be generally appealable. Okay. So adding to the end of those two lines the words without departure. I think that's in the set of amendments that's dated May 26th. The other language change is at line 32, and that is that the board has returned to the standard of substantial and compelling as the standard, the appropriate standard for appellate review. That is the language that was in the 1987 Act directing us to provide that review would be based on substantial and compelling reasons for departure. So the board's amendments propose that the words and compelling be added at line 32. Those are our amendments to Section 21. Now, I don't know. Ed Sullivan is now here. Did you want to make some comments before?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I guess my comments are limited to the two words and compelling on line 32 on page 11 of the bill. I was chair of the Governor's Task Force on Corrections in 1975 and 76. This was the one outstanding issue that was left, that of rationality of sentence review. The views expressed are solely my own. The scheme that's put before you today is that the presumption is to use the sentencing guidelines, and that it ought to be difficult to depart from those guidelines, and that concomitantly there would be a hard look if departure occurred. Now, there are two ends of this spectrum that we had to deal with. The first is a sort of substantial evidence review in which almost any reasons would be sufficient.
Excuse me.
Could
you introduce yourself
again? I'm Ed Sullivan. My address is 101 Southwest Main. I'm an attorney and former chair of the Governor's Task Force on Corrections. The balance is between substantial evidence on the one end, in which almost any reasons would be good enough, which a number of council members rejected, and sort of a comparative sentence review where you'd look at other sentences dealing with the same crime. The idea, though, was to presume to keep within the guidelines. Initially, the rejection was made by the council of the substantial and compelling standard to avoid comparative sentence review, that other end of the spectrum. But also the council rejected the substantial reasons or substantial evidence type of review because the idea of departure was supposed to be meaningful and consequently reviewable. The downside of rejecting substantial and compelling is that that standard is used already in Minnesota and Washington. On the other hand, we also have to keep the consensus of this bill, including Judge Joseph, together. And with the understanding that substantial reasons means sufficient legal reasons to support a departure from the state policy embodied in the guidelines, I hope that you'll keep the substantial reasons test in there and not go to substantial and compelling, which would erase that consensus in this very delicate balance. Judge Joseph has been a very articulate and certainly very outspoken person in this process. His feeling is that substantial and compelling will bring on comparative sentence review. We don't want that. We think it'll have fiscal implications beyond just getting this bill through, and we'd ask you to just to keep the substantial reason standard. Thanks.
Any questions? Judge Joseph?
Yeah.
Would you like to comment on this?
Well, I guess the last witness, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, that's up to you, Judge.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah. Senator Grinsky.
I'd like to see something like that every day.
Senator Hill.
Members of the committee, my name is George Joseph, Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, which up to now has been a very good job. When I left the office, my secretary said, just don't let them tack self-service gasoline on the end of the bill. And I said, I'm concerned about them sticking and compelling back in. You can take care of your own gasoline problem. I'm not quite sure for whom Ms. Bogan was speaking. Apparently, with the Criminal Justice Council, a deal isn't a deal unless you watch it forever. Because the last time I was present at a meeting of the council, there was spirited debate over the term and compelling. So spirited that, in effect, my old friend Jack Beatty told me to go to hell. He didn't use those words, he used stronger words than that, but in effect, he expressed disappointment in my attitude, my personality, and everything else. But there was then an effort to strike a compromise. And some of us were sent into the other room, Judge Robert E. Jones being one, the Solicitor General, Virginia Linder, being another. I was one, a staff member was there, and we spent some time hammering out a set of compromises on the matter of appellate review. And we came back in with a proposal that is now reflected in sections 20 and 21 of the engrossed bill. Now, I am aware, and I'm not sure whether any of you have received copies of a letter I sent today to Senator Cohen.
I do have that letter, Judge, and I'll hand that out for you right now.
All right. The part of it that I'm concerned with right now is this, that I have not paid much attention to the guideline rules as distinct from the statute, because I had assumed that the guideline rules would not affect my court's duties with respect to review. It was brought to my attention about a week ago, or a little more than a week ago, that the term substantial and compelling runs all the way through the rules, and I think I'm using the proper terminology of rules for the guidelines, as to what a trial judge, must find before he can depart from the guideline. Now, what I understood happened a week ago before the council was that a proposal was brought to the council to strike and compelling wherever it appears in the rules, in order that the rules would conform to the engrossed bill. Now I understand, although I was not there, I didn't know the matter was coming up in that way and wouldn't probably have been there anyway given my temper about this matter. The council apparently, as I understand it, rejected eliminating and compelling. Now, maybe by implication, that's going back on the agreement made with me and Judge Jones and others and adopted by the council. At least I understood Ms. Bogan to represent today that the council had now changed its mind on and compelling. I could not improve on Mr. Sullivan's statement of the reasons for getting rid of the words, or put differently and put accurately, I could not better state the reasons for not putting them back in as is proposed by one of the amendments before you today. I will not rehearse that. I do want to reiterate the warning that is in my letter to Senator Cohen that if those words go back in, we are playing on a different field with respect to what appellate court, particularly the appellate court of which I am the chief judge, will be doing in sentence review. We will be engaged in some sort of comparative sentence review, which I do not think is judicial business, and furthermore, has never been judicial business in this state.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Judge, may I interrupt?
Sure, I'm sorry.
Is that your understanding of what's happened in the Washington and Minnesota, if those are the states that have that language?
Senator Springer, I was just going to turn to that point.
Thank you.
I wish there were some way that this committee could go to Minnesota or talk to a judge in Washington about what's happened. Now, as you know, Senator Springer, perhaps better than anybody else on the committee right now, every time you talk to me, I start dropping numbers around. But I'm going to drop one on you right now, and I can only swear to it as of about 2 years ago. At a time when Oregon had 2,800 appeals being filed in the area of, the, generally speaking, criminal law, with its 2.5 million people, or 2.4 million, Minnesota, with its 5.6 million, I believe that's its population, had 800 of all sorts. Now, I can't account for that. There are a number, you've heard me tell the story here so many times. The Minnesota appellate load is not very heavy, and they have, the Minnesota courts have devoted themselves to developing a common law of sentencing for Minnesota. The fact that they've been able to do it in that milieu, to me, is neither proof that it is desirable or practicable. And I can assure you that Minnesota has considerably more appellate judges than this state has for a heck of a lot less business. Now, if you want to call any judge on the Washington Court of Appeals and ask what they actually do, what they actually do in the light of their statute, you may be amused, you may be shocked, but you will be impressed that they do not do what the statute says. In fact, they turn the job over to non-judicial people, and they stay as far away from it as they can. And as one of the judges there put it to me, I do not intend to spend my life as a judge looking over the shoulder of trial judges and comparing the sentence given in Tacoma with the sentence given in Vancouver. And the legislature can tell me to do that until the cows come home, and I'm just not going to do it, and we're not going to do it, and they don't do it. Now, I think someone ought to talk to some of those people and ask, in fact, what they do. It's important, and it's important for this reason. One of the primary guiding principles of the work of the Oregon Court of Appeals has been that judges do the intimate contact with the cases. Of course, we have help. We have staff help. We have staff counsel. We have clerks. But it is the judges who make the ultimate decisions. There are 10 of us. Our present filings are slightly less than 4,000. This will undoubtedly increase this. There will be some increase, don't misunderstand me. The bill itself will cause some increase. I'm not protesting that, given the way sections 20 and 21 now stand. But if you put in and compelling, and if you leave the statewide public defender office alive, I can assure you the mass of paper flow will increase probably exponentially. It is only fair that I say that the amendments proposed today contain an error and an omission, which I would point out just so there is not a, that in the event they're adopted, there is no misunderstanding. The terminology, I may say, I have to find the language. Sorry, I'm having trouble. Helen?
Yes, it's
on page what? Well, that's not what I'm talking about, where they were going, where they got the wrong reference to appeals.
Right.
Appeals from sentences.
Oh, I don't, I'm sorry. I don't know which
in
here's the.
Okay, I got that too. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. At the top of page 3 of the amendments, and I was not here, so I do not know whether Ms. Bogan mentioned this specifically. It says, notwithstanding the provisions, etc., a sentence imposed, etc., may only be appealed. Just technically, sentences are not appealed. Judgments are appealed. Later in the statute, there is a reference to appeals from judgments. That language should be clarified because we do not want anyone thinking that there can be an appeal from, quote, a sentence. The other thing is that there's a proposal to reinsert the words and compelling on page 11, line 32 of the A engrossed bill. But I think that if that is done, it also has to be done in line 41 of page 11, where it says substantial reasons for departure. I would think the words and compelling would have to be inserted in there if they go back. I could hardly resist the temptation to say that the, if it weren't changed, that the second section controls over the first, but I don't want to have to play that game. And I'm just pointing out that that would be that would also have to be a change. Thank you.
Thanks for coming over. Sorry, I missed it. I was next door defending one of our bills.
Well, I'm sorry. I would like you to hear Mr. Sullivan, though.
Jack, I mean, yes, Jack. Jack,
I've been called that, too. Judge, where can we put de novo review for workers' comp in there?
Put it in just after self-service gas at the end of the bill.
We got another bill for that.
Thank you.
You probably got another bill for the other one, too.
Are there any other questions?
He's made a compelling,
thank
substantial
you.
And compelling case.
We've been waiting for this, Judge, knowing that it would come.
Yes.
But we haven't yet heard the substantial and compelling case on the other side.
Okay.
Oh, well, if I may say one thing, you just said something I want to add. I was told this afternoon that the council regards this as a bottom line issue as to which there's no compromise. The reason that shocks me is because we did have a compromise on it one time. Apparently somebody doesn't like it. Thank you.
Where are we? We haven't gotten all the way through.
Would you like me to answer this note on the record, counsel, or what was your, which amendments are?
I think that would be helpful, though.
Okay. If I could perhaps defer the discussion on substantial and compelling.
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to have to leave very shortly as is Senator Grinsky, because so far as I know, the Labor Committee is indeed meeting this afternoon. And since this seemed to be the one point of contention, the rest of the amendments are informative at this point, and I assume we will return to the substance of the whole bill when we finally can get the whole thing together. But on this point of contention, I would like to hear the other arguments before I have to leave, while the issue is in my mind.
Well, Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we'll do our best.
What does that mean?
Excuse me?
Does that mean that you're... Okay, go ahead.
Judge Joseph is entirely correct that the council and I believe board meeting at which he attended, he successfully argued to eliminate the words "and compelling." It is also true that at the board meeting last week, the board voted after considerable discussion that they wanted to return to the standard of substantial and compelling. So I do not intend to come before you representing an implication that came out of the board meeting. It was a vote of the board to return to that standard. Judge Joseph is also completely right that judges in Minnesota and Washington operate under a substantial and compelling standard. There is considerable case law developed in those states interpreting what substantial and compelling means. I believe that was the reason why substantial and compelling was provided in the 1987 legislation calling for the development of the guidelines. It set out substantial and compelling as the test for departure, I think with an eye to the fact that we would have some body of case law out there somewhere that would give us an idea of how to interpret that language. Judge Joseph is right that those courts do not do comparative sentencing reviews, which I take to mean that the appellate court should not be put in the position to have to decide whether a 6-year sentence in this instance is appropriate given that someone who looked a little worse got 8 years and someone who looked a little better got 4 years. I think the council and the board have made it very clear all along that they did not intend to do the kind of comparative sentence review that I think the court is rightfully afraid of. That would be quite a burden. There's been some talk about the need for a database to do that, and that is not the standard of review that was intended. I think Ed Sullivan was completely right that what the board and the council were intending was something in the middle between a substantial evidence standard, and I think lawyers know to a certain extent what that means, and something that was a comparative sentence review standard. The board now feels most comfortable with substantial and compelling as a way to indicate something more than simply a substantial evidence test. I realize that this issue is not going to be resolved today. It'll have to be resolved, I think, before you all move the bill. I don't know what else to add except that there is a judge from Washington State coming down to testify before you next Wednesday who will, I think, be more than happy to talk about how that language has been played out in Washington. We do have a great deal of information about